Hello everybody and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report. Not just any episode, but a Wednesday episode. And you know what that means, don't you, JR?
Big news Wednesday. What can
always
you say? You know what? There's an honesty thing we like to do here at the Young Turks. And this Wednesday, the big news isn't as big.
No, it's not. It's not really. I mean, we have fairly big dog news. We've got big ice cream news. Not huge news, I'm not gonna lie to you.
Well, the problem is I end up shooting myself in the foot by promoting that so much because there's a time when I would say, oh, I never get sick. And then as soon as I said I never get sick, I got sick like the next day.
Yeah, and like when you hype the news cycle, it's like it raises the bar each time. So like if Trump doesn't get removed from office today, then you've failed. So we're gonna be watching. I hope he doesn't fail.
Wow, man, this set me up.
But anyway, look, we've got a lot that we're gonna get to. We've got two congressional candidates coming back on the show. Once again, Morgan Harper and Nabila Islam are gonna be joining us in a little bit. We're gonna be closing out the hour. Right at the end, Michael Bloomberg's ad strategy. I don't know what's going on, but we're gonna take a look at a couple of these ads. And we're gonna try to figure it out together, okay? But before that, why don't we touch base with what's going on with impeachment? Things have been moving fast because of John Bolton. So we're gonna be starting there. If you've been waiting to find out, will the new revelations from John Bolton's upcoming book, will that lead to witnesses? Then the answer I have for you is mixed. I don't really know. I don't know. There's stuff that points in both directions. So let's run through it and catch up a bit. Okay, in a private meeting on Tuesday, a group of GOP senators in competitive races, Joni Ernst of Iowa, Cory Gardner of Colorado, Martha McSally of Arizona, who we'll be returning to later on the show, and Tom Tillis of North Carolina told their colleagues that a drawn out trial would hurt them electorally. And there is no better way for this trial to be drawn out right now than if there were to be witnesses. And so they're very much against the idea. And so far, the only Republicans who seem almost certain to support witnesses in a vote are Susan Collins of Maine and Mitt Romney of Utah. By the way, one extra consideration that I haven't yet mentioned in all this, it's not clear if Chief Justice John Roberts would break a 50-50 tie for something like witnesses. And if he voted against it, obviously there'd be no witnesses. If he abstained, which seems maybe more likely, there would also be no witnesses because they need to get to 51 without John Roberts, who you would think as the presiding person on this would want more information, would want witnesses, but I kind of doubt that that would actually happen.
Probably not. There's a few things from these quotes that we already saw just now that stuck out to me. So the revelation was that these particular vulnerable senators, these Republican senators, they would hurt them electorally if this gets drawn out. The next question is, the discussion had to continue. I wish these sources would have at least finished the thought and be like, why?
Yeah, why
what is
exactly?
It about a drawn out process that will hurt these particular senators? Now, we see how a drawn out process can hurt Donald Trump because more information about what he has done, potentially has done, will come out and then people will see that and go, oh man, this guy's a bad guy for real. I keep seeing all his evidence is coming out in like mountains of evidence. When it comes to people like, you know, Joni Ernst, Martha McSally, Tom Tillis, what is it that they're associated with that they're gonna figure this is gonna hurt them electorally? What it is, my assumption, is their unwavering support in kneeling to Donald Trump. So as things hurt him, it hurts them, because as it goes on, they have to continue to defend him.
Yeah.
And to continue to lie on television. Yeah, so they're like, this is the only route I have. If I have to keep defending him, it's gonna hurt me.
Yeah.
They know how bad this is.
Yeah.
And they don't wanna have to actually do it very long.
Yeah, the only people in the Senate who can seriously say that their electoral chances are hurt by an extended trial without implicitly acknowledging that Trump is guilty are the Democrats who aren't able to campaign because of an extended trial. Right. Bernie Sanders can complain all he wants, and he's not admitting anything there. Right. He's just being honest. For them, though, they're not worried that it's gonna hurt them electorally because a whole bunch of witnesses are gonna be trotted out that have no evidence, nothing to say, it doesn't look bad for Trump. That doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. And I hate the same thing that you just said. Like, they never actually finished the thought, finished the question, get to the point. Now, all of that so far would lead you to believe that witnesses are apparently not going to come. And I do think that. However, yesterday, Mitch McConnell privately told GOP senators that there were not yet 51 votes against having witnesses either. So there's not 51 votes for either, which seems weird. You'd think it would go one way or another.
Right.
But basically that means that in addition to apparently Susan Collins and Mitt Romney, there is enough people, at least two, that haven't gone on the record yet. I don't know exactly who those are, and I don't know exactly which way they're gonna go, although I have my gut.
Yeah.
I think we're not gonna have witnesses, but just bear that in mind. Right now, it looks like it could go either way.
Well, I totally thought you were gonna be the optimist, because I like to go with the pessimism side. Because also, you know, those two names, Mitt Romney, Susan Collins. Susan Collins was telling someone earlier, I think it was maybe yesterday, that she's very likely to lean towards and possibly and sort of tip the scales and balance on the balance beam. Like, there's so many potential terms of, I was kind of disturbed. I'm sort of leaning. I may be considering, concerned, thought about. Which one is it? I get it. You don't want to make up your mind before it's over. But there's all these teasing lines, because the most important thing to people, the centrists or the moderates, is to be seen as moderates, not to actually be moderate.
Yeah, exactly. She could drag out for a week thinking about it to give herself that aura of reasonableness.
Yeah.
But in the end, her considering, her, you know, like all that could just end up being a con, basically. Yeah. Like her. One other consideration, by the way, and what I love doing is I love covering news that when you see it, you're like, how could that possibly be legal? But it's totally legal, because this is America, anything goes. Trump's lawyers gave thousands to Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, and Ted Cruz before the impeachment trial began.
Yeah.
Now look, you can go too far down this road. Like the whole Robert Mueller hired a guy who was a Democrat. Well, yeah, they all have affiliations. And look, I have no doubt that every one of Trump's lawyers is a Republican. Okay, that's one threshold. They're totally allowed to be that. Mm-hmm. But donating to them right before the trial, how is that not unethical? It's not to say that they can never have donated to Republicans. They're allowed to participate like any American. But like, you can't bribe a juror right before the trial, except that you totally can, and it's totally legal.
And this isn't something that just Democrats and libs make up to just say that's what happens. Your president, Donald Trump, said so while he was running. He goes, I've given to these people, and you know what I do when I give them? They come and they kiss my, so that they do what I tell them to, because I gave them money. So he gave up the game a long time ago for you guys, for you try to act like you don't know what it is. So when this happens, it's an admission of the way it's gonna work. And in any other circumstance, it just wouldn't work out. And also, the one other line we heard from Mitch McConnell afterwards, he goes, we're gonna follow the lead of the White House attorneys. When you say something like that after they gave you money, it's just, it's hard to separate the two.
Yeah.
He literally said it on Sean Hannity's show. We're gonna follow the lead of the White House attorneys.
Because
White House attorneys
gave
you money.
It's insane. It's insane. But let's turn to one other aspect of this. Since the Bolton revelations came out at the beginning of this week, the reaction from the Trump camp has been fairly muted. Everyone else on the right is like destroying him. But Trump has mostly stayed out of it. That ended this morning with him tweeting about John Bolton. He tweeted, for a guy who couldn't get approved for the ambassador to the UN years ago, couldn't get approved for anything since, in quotations, begged me. So did he beg or did he not? Like, just right begged. Begged me for a non-Senate approved job, which I gave him, despite many saying, don't do it, sir. Takes the job, mistakenly says Libyan model on TV. What a weird reference to throw into that tweet. And many more mistakes of judgment. Gets fired because, frankly, if I listen to him, we would be in World War VI by now. Wait, well, okay, good news, everybody. We survived 3 and 4. And goes out and immediately writes a nasty and untrue book. All classified national security. Who would do this? You know what I love? My favorite brand of Trump wanting to have his insult and eat it too is like when he hires someone, they're super complimentary, they shower him with compliments, then it's a disaster. They eventually fire them. Then he has to like try to take that person down more. And he's like, he was stupid, nobody ever respected him, who would possibly want to work with him? But you hired him. Why did you hire him if he's been bad forever?
It's always been that. It's every one of them. And then they call them disgruntled employees, disgruntled fired people. How about a disgruntled employer who's the one who brought him? Every time he's the one that's so angry when someone leaves and says, man, you know what happened there? Because for some reason, again, they don't know when they took the job that Donald Trump was going to be Donald Trump. And they walked in, they said, man, this guy is acting like Donald Trump or someone. And it's really annoying. I don't know how it got this way. Then they leave and go, I'm going to write down all the things that he did. And then it turns the fact that it's happened so many times, and then anytime you see a pattern, you see the common denominator is this one guy. For some reason, there's a certain percentage of people that don't see the same common denominator as the guy who keeps getting mad that everyone else leaves and says, wow, that was the worst job I've ever had.
Yeah. Now, excitingly, really fast, we have two updates to the story. One, as of this morning breaking, one even more recently breaking. It's still in the process of breaking. So let's start with the milder one. CNN just reported the White House has issued a formal threat to Bolton to keep him from publishing his book. There's been no comment yet about that from the White House, Bolton, the book publishers, but we can comment.
I don't know exactly what, I looked for details. There's no details, there's no letter, at least not that we've seen yet.
They're gonna say that he's spreading information of import to national security or whatever.
I don't know how much you have to prove it, because the MO, at least the approach that this administration's always had to take is say it and then everyone has to believe it.
Yeah.
No evidence, no basis behind any of it, but just say it. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's the route we'll go with, and then maybe they'll intimidate people enough. I don't know what the response is going to be, but no one wants to talk about it yet in response.
Yeah. And we also have this. So this is a breaking tweet from Andrew Desiderio. Breaking, House Foreign Affairs Chairman Elliot Engel says Bolton told him on a September 23rd call that, quote, the committee look into the recall of Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch and, quote, strongly implied that something improper had occurred around her removal as our top diplomat in Kiev. So Elliot Engel, like 3 months later, recalls that Bolton sort of was a whistleblower, maybe not the whistleblower, although maybe also the whistleblower, which would be interesting because just one day after that call on Twitter, Ken Klippenstein said that because we live in the stupidest world possible, the stupidest thing always has to be true, which means that the whistleblower has to be a disgruntled John Bolton. He might be right.
Wasn't there a second whistleblower after? Remember,
at the very least the second whistleblower.
Trump talked about the second whistleblower and the second and the second whistleblower and the second whistleblower.
Yeah,
I mean, who knows?
It might actually be him. And look, all of this is just to say, if he's making these bold claims, and apparently he's been doing it for a long time, and if they are saying no, that's not true, and in fact he's saying things apparently that are true because they have to be blocked from publication at the very least. Then we gotta get him in under oath and ask him questions, and probably Giuliani and all the rest too. It just makes sense. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, a candidate is gonna join us after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Now joining us once again on the show, congressional candidate for Ohio's 3rd District, Morgan Harper. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Thanks for having me. Good to be back.
Glad to have you on. It's been a little bit since we touched base with your candidacy, and things are moving fast. There's actually going to be a debate in the very near future. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, we're now 48 days out from Election Day on March 17th. We're having our first candidate forum this Sunday, 1:30 p.m. We have people that are reaching out to us like, oh, what's the live stream going to be? So we're really excited. It's a chance to just continue to spread our message throughout the 3rd District that we deserve to have a community where everyone has a home, healthcare. We're doing something about the climate, and I couldn't be more excited to get in front of more people here.
So tell me a little bit about what having this, not just having a debate, but having a debate with the Democratic incumbent. This is Joyce Beatty. Like, as outsiders in the media, we often look at when debates are turned down by incumbents. We get frustrated about it because it seems like political cowardice. Mm-hmm. And certainly having a debate is an opportunity for the challengers. For you at this point in your candidacy, what are some of the things you're hoping to accomplish with a debate? Why is that sort of not just like appearing before people, but specifically with the Democratic incumbent, why is that important?
Well, one, it's a huge deal. I mean, when I first started this, we talked about it when I've been on before, you know, people didn't think we would get any traction. So even the fact that this is happening is a demonstration of how much people are hungry for a change in the status quo because they know it is not serving us. And we have built a grassroots groundswell that has put pressure on this whole event even happening, right? So that's just a proof of concept in terms of grassroots campaigns. But also, it's an opportunity for people who have been living in a gerrymandered district, which means it's safely Democratic, and there hasn't been any competition for 8 years, to actually have something to talk about, right? To have some choice here. And it's democracy at work. Primaries matter. That people even know that they have a primary on March 17th is a huge deal. And then finally, it's a chance to present a real distinction for people where, you know, to date, my opponent and I have both been appearing in public, but never together. So maybe you catch one of those conversations, maybe you happen to see me online or whatever, but to have a side-by-side comparison in terms of the visions that we're talking about of what's possible at the federal government is really going to be impactful for people. And it hasn't happened in a long time, and folks are hungry for it.
So obviously, as you just said, you're going to lay out competing visions. Obviously, you're going to talk about your platform, how it differs. In this sort of situation where you've got a Democratic incumbent, apparently the Franklin County Democratic Party is there's plans to endorse Beatty after the debate, or actually
well, that's
before
happened, actually before
oh
debate.
It did okay
yeah,
okay happened. Well, then maybe that changes the calculation, but I'm curious, how aggressive do you go then? How much of this is just about presenting yourself to the voters, and how much is presenting who you think Beatty is to the voters?
Well, throughout the entire campaign, I've been focused on introducing myself to the community, you know, number one, in terms of why I'm doing this. Because that's usually the question, especially in these primaries against a Democratic incumbent. Why are you doing this instead of going against a Republican, right? And we've made the case over the past 7-8 months that not all Democrats are created equal. We have the ability to really be a national champion on a lot of the issues that are the issues of our time across the country that are facing our community, like climate, you know, backing things like the Green New Deal. And we deserve to have a choice here, and I'm presenting that. And so that's what I'm, you know, really looking forward to, and what I think is going to be important to make the case to make on Sunday at the candidate forum in the debate.
I want to ask you just one more question about that endorsement, because our producers found that the husband of Representative Beatty is a member of the endorsement committee. It seems like you might be biased towards your partner. Now, granted, she is the incumbent, but what's interesting is that back in 2012, there was a competitive primary in the same district, and they did not preemptively endorse. Do you think it's appropriate for them to be endorsing not only during the primary, but before the first debate, the first chance to really see the competing visions of the two candidates?
No, I think it's completely inappropriate. I mean, that's why I actually said that I wasn't going to participate in the screening process, that there shouldn't be any endorsement. We have here two credible candidates. We outraised my opponent from a fundraising perspective in the first quarter. We have a lot of buy-in from students, people living throughout the 3rd District who are really excited about our campaign. And the party shouldn't be choosing sides before, as you said, we've even had one debate for people to compare what we're talking about and what decisions they could be making in this race. And so, you know, the fact that they endorsed last week, that the state party endorsed the week before without any conversation between the two of us, the incumbent and myself, and a chance for voters to hear from us directly, is really disappointing. And it's also part of the problem. It's part of the reason why we have, you know, such a high percentage of the electorate that doesn't even participate in these types of races and why people don't believe in politics. And our race is a testament that people want to believe, but it's got to be authentic politicians that are coming from a place of not trying to get rich, but trying to actually serve the public.
Morgan, it's JR. I feel like I kind of asked a similar version of this question to many of the candidates, but also I see that you were last week, you were at a Green New Deal panel where you were talking to many voices that would probably agree with it or are on board, at least to hear how something like that would work. And I'm assuming that went well, but as you've campaigned, people that particularly may be on the opposite side of the political aisle or don't have much trustworthiness towards Democrats, have you seen that as you go with just the issues and the agenda and actual policies, that those people have heard you and are thinking, man, I didn't think this was actually something that would help all of us? Have you seen it crossing lines from your perspective?
Oh, for sure. And you know, I'll say, I mean, a lot of people that I talk to throughout the third district haven't heard about the Green New Deal, right? And so, you know, what we're doing in this last phase of the campaign up until Election Day is hosting, in addition to doing, you know, larger events, we had over 200 people that came out to the Green New Deal town hall. We're hosting community rallies in every neighborhood where we're canvassing. And that's a real cross section. That's people that we knocked on your door or you saw Facebook ad or posting about it, and you were like, you know what, a Saturday night in the middle of winter in Ohio, I'm gonna come out and hear from this chick who's running for Congress, right? And so it's people that aren't necessarily the typical, you know, political figure. They're not the people that show up at the state party building, all that. And Green New Deal is a big topic because why? Because everybody agrees that the climate crisis is real. You have a lot of, you know, especially the 30% of the black population, 30% of the district that is the black population here, has this legacy of, you know, industry that was in right in our communities and then left, and we're left with a legacy of environmental risk, right? And so people, one, know what that means, even though that's often thought of as maybe a little bit of a lofty topic, but then also, hey, if this has the ability to create jobs that are living wage jobs that are going to address the infrastructure and transportation issues that have hobbled people here, that have prevented mobility and made this one of the most economically segregated places in the entire country, mm-hmm. we're all ears, right? Mm-hmm. And so that has been a really powerful topic. And that is the work, grassroots, door by door, block by block, educating folks about what this could mean and unleashing the possibility of legislation that is thinking in a big way to address the climate crisis.
I want to ask just one follow-up about the people who you found that oppose the Green New Deal when they find out about it. Because obviously they're supporting or opposing a plan. But when I see Fox News, for instance, talking about the Green New Deal, they're not talking about it as something that we're opposed to. They're trying to pitch it as something that is insane, unworkable, that would destroy the economy, fundamentally un-American. So when you're talking to regular voters and you find that they might not be supportive of the Green New Deal, are they able to be persuaded, or do they think that this is some sort of like Soviet plot to destroy the foundation of our economy?
People are persuadable, but that's work, right? So, you know, I actually had a friend who, I don't even know how he would politically identify, honestly, at this point after our campaign. But, you know, when I first said I'm backing the Green New Deal, it's been on the platform since day one. It's like, oh, Morgan, this is crazy. You know, these crazy ideas, these socialist ideas, whatever, right? I was like, oh, well, have you read it, the resolution? Answer, no. Mm-hmm. Very common response. Never read it, but I've heard the buzzwords or I've heard the media spin about it, and it's outlandish. And then that same friend went back, read the resolution, came back to me and was like, Morgan, this makes a lot of sense. All right, I'm all in, right? And so, you know, this is again, a theme of the campaign is people have been hearing a lot of spin. There's a lot of brainwashing about what we can't do at the federal government because it's irresponsible or, you know, too out there. And that's what we have to deprogram people into believing. It's like, no, in fact, this is the exact role of the federal government. And we have to have political leadership that is going to fight to address the issues of our time and make sure that everybody is able to lead a stable life in our community, awesome. Including in a safe environment.
Morgan, where can people find out more about your race?
Ooh, okay. Well, you can find out more by texting Morganize to 44939. Now we're texting. Go to morganharper.org. 48 days left. Please chip in whatever you can. We're ready to win this thing.
Morgan Harper, candidate in Ohio's 3rd District. Thank you again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break, but stick around. Lots more to get to. Earlier this week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo had a breakdown during an interview with NPR reporter Mary Louise Kelly when she asked him questions about Ukraine. He lost it. He took her into a room, yelled at her for 9 minutes, gave her an impromptu geography test, which she apparently passed, and that made him even more mad. And to me, as an outsider, and I think a reasonable person, that's just pathetic. Like, it's intellectually pathetic. Why are you yelling at this reporter? She's asking you very reasonable questions, but that's just for me. For a certain type of guy, him yelling at her for 9 minutes straight and swearing at her, very impressive behavior. Now let's go now to one of those types of guys.
Impressive, Mike. That reporter couldn't have done too good a job on you yesterday. Huh? I think you did a good job on her, actually. That's good. Thank you, Mike. Great.
So, look, he's praising Pompeo. She didn't do a good job on you. I don't really know what that means. You did a good job on her. He like was asked questions, which he wilted under. He folded. What do they say, like a flan in the cupboard? And then started yelling at her, challenged her, gave her like this challenge, like, I bet you can't point out Ukraine on a map, which she then did. Haha, you did a pretty good job on her. What are you talking
all
about?
All it takes is for someone to be outlandish, angry, and lash out. That's a good job for him because he thinks that's showing strength. Instead of actually answering a question, like showing intelligence, showing any kind of I guess, readiness to answer questions. I don't feel like this is something that he should have not been prepared for. Mm-hmm. Even if you're preparing to lie like you usually do, at least prepare to get the question instead of, now we've gotten to the point where I can't lie anymore because I'm looking bad every day. Mm-hmm. So now the approach is to lambast, destroy, demean anyone who asks the question and say it's their fault for asking that question. We didn't agree to talk about things that are going on in the country.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? But that's how it works. Trump knows that and he's like, I need to galvanize their resolve behind my lies. Mm-hmm. So publicly, I have to thank him and congratulate him for doing the worst thing he could do.
Yeah, no, look, the video that we showed had the shot of Mike Pompeo, like he's smiling. Everybody's cheering for him in what looks like a crowd of 90% men. Alan Dershowitz pats him on the back at one point to add a little bit more creepiness to it. But really fast, I want to go to an alternate perspective. This is going to stay, same video, but this is going to stay on Donald Trump's face. And you know what situation we're talking about, what it represents. I want you to look at the facial expressions of Donald Trump as he goes through this whole speech.
Wow, that's impressive. That was very impressive, Mike. That reporter couldn't have done too good a job on you yesterday. Huh? I think you did a good job on her, actually.
How like... weirdly, like, so happy is. Like, there was this woman, she asked you tough questions, she came with like receipts, and you just lost your mind on her. That's strong. You know, I used to fight with my younger brother a lot when we were really young. We'd fight, and I was a year older and a little bit bigger at the point. He's now way bigger, so I don't fight him anymore. But at that point, I was bigger, so we'd fight, and I would win. I was a year older, it would happen. Mm-hmm. We would fight. 10 minutes later, he'd come back, we'd fight again. I'd win. 10 minutes later, he'd come back, we'd fight again. Until eventually, and this always happened, 3 or 4 fights in a day, he would run and get a knife, and I would run to my bedroom and shut the door. From Trump's point of view, that is a sign of strength, that you lost your mind and escalated things to an insane level. From my point of view, maybe like fight better. Don't get the knife.
Don't train.
You weirdo.
Figure it out.
Yeah, he's a good guy now, but he tried to knife me.
I totally thought you made that part up.
No, it's totally true. But anyway, that's not what strength is. How have we gotten to this point where men in America, lots of men, but especially on the right, they have no idea what being strong is. Yeah. And so anything that's big and demonstrative is just assumed to be strong.
It's all an appearance. And again, the one thing I also wondered and noticed with that, after he congratulated Pompeo, he got a standing ovation.
Yeah.
And Trump wasn't expecting it. Part of his issue, he's looking around going, wow, you must have done a good job because people are applauding you. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, you mean a bunch of sycophants are applauding something that you looked bad in doing. So my wonder was, man, he's starting to think, this Pompeo guy is getting a little bit too big here. Because his gauge for anything that's successful is everyone congratulating me? Does everyone love me?
Yeah.
And until then, he surrounds himself with people who love him. And then that's what he sees as a success.
I want you to look good, but not too good. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. Stick around. Just a few days ago, I saw a tweet from a congressional candidate, Nabila Islam, who's been on the show before, and it was about how she wanted the FEC to allow her to spend campaign funds on healthcare, which makes a lot of sense. Because if you're running, especially for the first time, running for an office like that, you generally have to stop working. You are burning through the money that you have. And for people like you need to have health insurance. These sorts of costs aren't often factored in when we think about the reality of running for political office. This could be a major, major change in the right direction. And so I am very excited now to welcome to the show once again, Nabila Islam, running for Georgia's 7th District.
Thanks for having me back. I'm super excited.
Glad to have you back on the show. So tell me about this request.
Yes. So for the first time in history, I'm asking the FEC to allow candidates like me to be able to use campaign funds in order to pay for health insurance. Right now, as you mentioned, working class candidates, I'm running full time, burning through my savings, and I can't afford health insurance. And I believe that candidates while on the trail should have health care.
So look, I'm curious about how important this could be for making Congress more representative of the American people. As the Washington Post noted, 3% of the US population are millionaires, 40% of Congress are millionaires. Do you think that this sort of thing, which is just, it's not even talked about, is one of the reasons that you end up with effectively a ruling class of like economic elites?
Absolutely. The system wasn't designed for candidates like me. As I mentioned, these are structural barriers that prevent people like me from running for office. I saw when I rolled out with this FEC,
request
is that Tiffany Caban actually reached out and said that she almost didn't run for office because between her health insurance and student loans, it was too cost prohibitive to run for office in the first place. And so if the FEC rules in our favor, this would open the floodgates for many people like candidates like me to run for office, working class candidates, women of color, so we can have a reflective Congress that looks like America today.
Do you expect that you will get a response from the FEC in a time frame where it would actually be helpful for your race?
I'm hoping so. Right now they don't have quorum, and I'm hoping that they reach quorum immediately. It's critical that they do so that they can address cases like mine. Candidates like me should have healthcare while they run for office. And so I'm hoping that we have a speedy response.
You know, this sort of reminds me of a story I remember from a couple of months ago. And I apologize if I'm wrong. I believe it was about Rashida Tlaib's congressional, her first run, where she had asked her campaign something along the lines of getting a loan to be able to pay for rent to cover while she's running. And it didn't blow up into a big scandal or anything, but the right was like trying to make it a scandal. When the scandal, from my point of view, should be that if you're running, and it's not like you're running for a month, AOC was campaigning for like 18 months, not able to work, how are you supposed to pay for rent and healthcare? Your kids need to be watched, those sorts of things. So tell me a little bit about your experience running. How significant are those sorts of economic hurdles?
Oh, they're huge. I mean, the system thinks that you need to be a millionaire in order to run for office. And so I'm draining through my savings, having to pay for rent, utilities, I'm eating ramen and biryani every week. That's the only thing that I can afford. Working class candidates, it's really hard to run for office because it is cost prohibitive. And in fact, you can't even use campaign funds until you qualify. I've been running for a year now, and my qualifying period isn't until March. And so you have to wait that long in order to be able to even take a salary.
Nabila, it's JR. We focus a lot of times about the health of candidates. We talk about Bernie Sanders' health issues. When Hillary was running, there was that fainting episode. And it becomes a negative if someone actually has a health problem. You would think, I'm not sure if you would use that part as far as your pitch, but if you want candidates to be healthy, maybe we should make sure we have avenues to make sure that they're healthy. Maybe to continue on, since that's always a negative if they can't continue on. But on top of that, it made me wonder, there's staff that works for you, obviously, in any campaign. Is there an avenue you could see where it could also provide some level of healthcare for the staff as well? Because they're working hard to get this done too. And if nothing else, you're only as good as how much support you have to get it done. Is there an opening for that as well that you're planning?
Well, right now, my staff receives a stipend for healthcare, and that is legal by law. But I cannot receive a stipend for healthcare. So that's what I'm asking the FEC is I'm asking them if I'm able to use campaign funds in order to pay for my healthcare, because we should have healthy candidates. I'm shaking hands every day on the campaign trail, so I'm terrified of catching the flu or something like that. And having to go see a doctor, which would put me in medical debt. And so this is something that's critical to have on the campaign trail, most definitely.
I want to ask you a little bit about the campaign, because it's been a bit since we last spoke. And you know, one thing, I don't know, maybe it's a touchy subject. In terms of media coverage of candidacies like yours, in a lot of races, they just totally ignore you. There's no coverage whatsoever. You have been generating a good amount of coverage. And one of the things that has been sticking throughout this is the reference to you as Atlanta's own AOC. Is that helpful or is that frustrating to be constantly compared to another candidate in a very different part of the country, like on this recurring basis when the media is discussing you?
I'm honored that they're comparing me to Congressman Ocasio-Cortez. I think she has been a game changer in politics today. But I like to tell people that I'm gonna be the first Nabila Islam of my district. And so is it frustrating? No, but I am my own person. And so I understand that people like to continue to make that reference, but I'm running a campaign that's specific to my community. And I'm talking about the issues that affect my community on a day-to-day basis.
And so could you give us just a quick update on how the campaign has been developing, any big upcoming dates if people wanna know, you know, what's going on, what's coming up?
Absolutely. So we've been building off of the momentum since last year. We got a couple of endorsements from Blue America PAC, Engage, Marianne Williamson actually endorsed me as well.
Oh, wow.
Yes, and super excited about that. And we are, you know, we're hitting the ground running. And so we're canvassing every single day. We're doing phone banks. I have an immigration forum tomorrow. The primary itself is May 19th, so we have about 4 months to go. And I think folks are really excited about this campaign. And if people want to get involved, they can go to my website at nabilaforcongress.com and sign up to volunteer.
Awesome. And you know, I want to thank you once again for joining us and for this movement that you've started. I hope that the FEC gets its, you know, stuff together in time to help you out. Unfortunately, it seems like the Republicans have no interest in the FEC ever having a quorum. So you know, best of luck to you as you continue to struggle with the system as it's been set up.
Thank you. I'm going to keep fighting.
Awesome. We're going to take one last break here, but stick around. We've got some weird stuff after this. And now it's time for the latest in our ongoing segment, Am I Being Unfair? So I'm gonna show you an interaction that Mike Bloomberg, presidential contender, had, not with a human, but with a dog. And I wanna know if I'm being unfair in my reaction to this. Okay. Here's the video.
Okay, good boy, now shake.
What is shake. Going on?
So I think he missed the memo about how to teach a dog to shake. Use paw.
Just use whichever part of its body looks hand-shaped at the time.
Now, if you're gonna make a joke, if you're gonna say, oh yeah, I'm shaking hands and kissing babies, mm-hmm. I even shook a dog's hand. Like, it's humorous, but he looked confused a little bit.
So, look, I'm not mad, obviously. I don't wanna go crazy. And I know that people say, you know, you're biased for Bernie. You're so mean to all the other candidates. Look, there are worse things he could have done. I get what he's doing. He's trying to show I'm comfortable with dogs. I'll mess with a dog, you know, I'll do that. And I do that. I'm super weird with dogs.
John does it all the time.
I'm super weird with dogs. But like your finger's like right next to its eye. Not the eyes, but the dog. Seems happy enough. The owner seems okay. So I don't want to go crazy, but it's a little bit weird.
Yeah,
okay?
I mean, I'm not sticking my hand in the dog's mouth to potentially bite or whatever. I don't know. I mean, if I'm like, dog's yeah. face. Like, you're supposed to approach a dog a certain way. I hear again, it's not a huge deal. It's just odd.
Yes. Well, if you think that's odd, wait until you see the update, because there was a bit of a social media uproar over the, you know, the face bonk or swooch or whatever he's doing. So they released a response. Here's the tweet announcing it. It's the second tweet. Dog people get me. Dogs too. Hashtag dogs for Mike. Here's the video.
Oh, Bloomberg is the man to lead us.
He will create more jobs.
Mike's not afraid of the NRA, not one bit.
Trust me, Mike will get it done, yeah.
Get it done, yes.
He does not tweet. Oh.
I like Mike.
I like Mike. I lick Mike. I'm Mike Bloomberg's dog. I approve this message.
I'm Mike Bloomberg, and I approve this message.
Now look, that is so corny and so I love dogs. I can't help but kind of like that.
Yeah,
it's not, I don't want to.
It's literally
but
not.
I kind of like it.
It's not taking itself too seriously. But
the corgi, get it done. Yes.
But that's the thing. It'll speak to people like mm-hmm. you. People like me. I'm like, oh, he's trying. That doesn't penetrate my black heart. Mm-hmm. I just. Go
well, you don't like dogs. You have a great dog. You don't even like your dog.
I love dogs. I don't like when we try to associate human characteristics on dogs because yeah. they wouldn't want that.
You mean so the voice must bother you then?
I speak for the dogs. when they put a sweater on it, and then we should put a dog treating them off, and I'll voice it over and go, "Take the sweater off of me. Well, I have one."
We got to make a version of this then. with our dogs. Look, he's gonna be able to respond within an hour to anything that happens because his digital media team apparently has had $1 billion spent on it. So they're super fast. That was kind of cute. The whole thing is cheesy. And look, I don't like that all of this has nothing to do with what he would actually do as president. So that frustrates
me.
But
it works.
But the dogs are cute. Mm-hmm. Okay, now with that, let's turn to maybe even a weirder story involving Mike Bloomberg. Mike Bloomberg has a new ad? I don't know. Take a look.
Where's my ice cream? Ah, thank you. Big gay ice cream is the best.
I don't think I survived that plane landing or whatever. That's not a deep fake, apparently. I don't know how it's not a deep fake. What's the ice cream that...
Yeah, the way he
what is going on in America?
Watch how he approaches the spoon.
It's like he's never eaten ice cream before.
This is the result of someone with too much money running for president because they feel they need to have this, I don't know, on their resume. Mm-hmm. But and then you have so much money, like, I don't know, let's just make random ads. Again, there has to be an explanation. What is big gay ice cream? I gotta look it up apparently now. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's part of the ploy here. I gotta look up big gay ice cream.
I don't know.
Maybe it's
I'm
better.
Interested. I am interested. So look, this is another one of the things he put out. They've got so much money. They say, apparently, he's gaining ground on Trump's formidable digital operation. Hopefully not exclusively with these sorts of ads. But Trump has spent $36 million on Google and Facebook. He has already spent $34 million on Facebook and Google. I mean, just a crazy amount. To give you an idea of how much he's spending, in just 2 months, he has spent $10.6 million on television and advertising. In Pennsylvania.
Jesus.
We're not even talking about Pennsylvania yet, and he's already spent more than some candidates have raised for the entirety of this thing.
No, we gotta.
He can hire a million people.
It's
he has so much money.
Strictly a matter of where can I throw this money? Because, I mean, again, if I'm a billionaire, I've said this to Anna several times, I have this dream. Mm-hmm. I want a big warehouse garage full of old cars that I just sit and work on all day. If I was a billionaire, if I was even a multimillionaire, you wouldn't see or hear from me again because you'd be like, you know where to find JR? Go knock on the warehouse door. He's underneath a car changing something, right?
JR's garage.
So if I've got this much money, I guess I'll throw it at that, but it still wouldn't be 10.6 million.
Just for Pennsylvania.
Just for one state. Again, I don't know what the cling is. This seems too stressful to run this candidacy when you can just go and chill.
Yeah,
just relax.
Chill with some ice cream. Big gay ice cream.
Big gay ice cream.
But yeah, I mean, look, he's spending a ton of money. And here's the thing. I know that, like, that joke's ridiculous. That thing is ridiculous. And the dog thing's ridiculous. This is a joke. Why are you paying attention to this? Well, there's one reason. Bloomberg hit 12%, surpassing Buttigieg in a new Morning Consult national poll. Like, this works. That's why they spend so much money. And look, I will admit, this is something I'm thinking about now. Are we doing what he wants us to do, even in this right now? Is this just a non-xenophobic version of what Trump did? He's always there. He's always in every conversation. He's always gonna have ice cream to eat. and then he wins. Is that what we're setting up for?
Well, if it is what we're setting up for, it is not our fault. Because you know what shouldn't happen? Americans shouldn't decide who they're voting for based off of an ice cream or dogs being chewing. We're going to watch an Air Bud movie next and be like, hey, Mike Bloomberg's dog was the one who dunked an Air Bud. No, who cares? But that's an indictment of our society as a whole. We somehow decide presidential candidates based off of things like this.
Yes.
That's our fault.
I agree. That is an indictment of American society. In fact, this show is intended as an indictment of American society. And never more than on JR Wednesdays. Okay, so this is John and JR from a little bit later on. So after we finished that segment, we did look up the ice cream place after we heard from the director that it's actually awesome. So we looked it up. It is apparently at the very least a food truck. They might have a retail location too, but it's described as charismatic owners top cones with wacky fixings. And that does sound really awesome. It doesn't answer any of our other questions about why he did this in particular, but the next time I'm in New York, I want to try this ice cream.
Well, because Bloomberg is making the comparison. They top their ice cream with wacky fillings?
Fixings.
Fixings. Yeah. So he's topping his candidate with wacky
wacky digital ads.
It's really weird. There's parallels, I guess.
Okay, in the end, maybe it actually makes sense. But we did look into it. Okay, we're going to keep an eye on him, though. Don't worry about that. JR, as always, thank you for joining me. Great to have you here.
I'm going
to
go get some big ice cream.
I want to find out what it is. Is it an actual product that you can buy? Is this supposed to be his counter to Ben and Jerry being behind Bernie Sanders? Where does Bluebell line up in all this? These are important questions. We will delve into them later on. Okay, we're running out of time. Thank you, everybody, for joining me. Great to have you here. More planned from throughout the week. So,
Bloomberg Air Bud 2020.
Animals are innocent.
The Lincoln Project is a conservative group that has been putting out ads attacking Republican candidates, interestingly. And they've been pretty rough. We've got a new one, this is their fourth, attacking Martha McSally, who, if you don't know, in 2018, she was appointed to serve in the Senate for John McCain's seat when interim Senator John Kyle retired in 2019. She had previously run and lost, but then was just handed a spot in the Senate, which they point out in this ad.
Martha McSally, Arizona rejected you in 2018, and you know why. You were too close to Donald Trump, and you lost badly. Now you've gone full Trump again.
Man, you're a liberal hack. I'm not talking to you.
You knew Arizona wanted the truth. We demanded witnesses and evidence in the trial of Donald Trump. Oh, there's a reason your poll numbers are dropping fast. And you're on your way to defeat. Oh, that's right, Martha. Again. Arizona has always produced mavericks, true independents. People like John McCain and Barry Goldwater. Senators that served Arizona. People of courage, toughness. They stood for what was right, no matter the political risk. And they are remembered as American heroes. And you, Martha, you'll be remembered as just another Trump hack. If you're remembered at all.
Whew. So look, I think of myself as, like, I get really mad at Republicans. Like, I hate Donald Trump and several other people. But even as I was watching that, I was thinking, this is mean. You're being really mean right now. You need to tone down the mean. If you remembered it all.
The Lincoln Project, who else did they come after? They've had like three of these ads that are really good, but they've come after
I think one of them might have been Mitch McConnell, I think. One was Joni Ernst,
yeah,
I think.
Joni Ernst, Susan Collins.
Susan Collins was the really bad one. But that was so sneering, but you, Martha McSally.
No.
My God.
This lady that voices over these ads, like, this is the person you want as, like, your spokesperson before a fight. Like, you're in a bar.
Yes.
And is like, how about you, Jim? Look at your face. I bet my friend JR is going to whoop your ass.
Probably,
like,
yeah.
It's filthy. It's like, it gets you going, like, oh my God. But this is how Republicans fight.
They are more effective at being unrepentantly dirty and underhanded.
There are these like political standards, I guess, that are unwritten rules where you roll up your sleeves at an event or at a disaster area. Or then if you're going after an opponent, don't say them by name because you might promote them. You know, those things to be polite and don't call someone a liar.
Yeah.
They cross all of these rules and be like, Martha McSally, look at her face. Mm-hmm. She doesn't know what she's doing. Look at her kissing Trump's ass. So then, like, you go, oh my gosh.
Who is the comedian that talked about habitual line steppers? Was it Charlie Murphy said it? Republicans in campaigns are habitual line steppers. They find the line, they cross it. And they're doing that here. There are three quick reasons why I wanted to cover this. One, because it's funny, come on. Two, because we wanted some Republicans to fight back against the whole Trump thing. This is that. But three, it is good that they're using their money to attack a bad Republican. I will grant you that. But that sort of ad is, look, I couldn't identify anything that I found to be untrue, which is good because we don't want falsehoods in ads. But it is so effective just in the way it makes you despise the person that, like, this is why I don't want billions of dollars flooding into these elections, because that sort of ad could just as easily be run against any other candidate, even good candidates. And all they have to do is play the music and some they black and white, and you start to hate everyone.
It's one of those things, and you have to. The reason I think Republicans do this, again, it goes to the electorate, or at least the general public that you're generally that you're trying to appeal to. Republicans are okay with this. They're like, Yeah, but as you said, you watched it and you don't like very many of these Republicans, but you thought somewhere in your heart, this is mean.
Yeah.
There's something in your DNA that generally makes up a lot of times progressives versus people who are more lean the other way is they're okay with viciousness. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of Democrats. If a Democrat put out this ad on someone else, they would start going, oh my God, this guy's a mean person. I don't want to vote for him. And it turns people off. This turns their voters on against that person.
I like it. It just makes me uncomfortable at the same time.
I mean, look, you guys, we talk about Bernie Sanders apologizing for a surrogate saying something about Joe Biden.
Yeah.
That's how Democrats work.
Yeah.
You have to apologize, you're just gonna lose some voters.
Yeah.
It's the complete opposite. They know how to hit those nerves and they go, yeah, Martha McSally.
Yeah.
So when they're in the voting booth, you know, when they see her name, they'll go, Martha McSally.
maybe.
It's filthy, I love it though.
Okay. Look, I guess I'm looking forward to their next ads. We'll see what's to come.
Let's hope it's not on you.
Yeah. Okay, so this was an unprompted OT, but I want to thank you for sticking around and watching this. We'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.